These violent delights have violent ends.
Welcome to Violent Delights, a Westworld podcast. We're your hosts, Andrew Cersini,
Dwayne D.
and Tosin Unafawakin.
We just watched the sixth episode of Westworld's third season titled Decoherence. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. Before we dive into the aftertalk, let's give you some online spots you can get in contact with us. You can write to us or email us a voice memo at hbowestworldpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at @HBOWestworldPod or just hashtag Violent Delights. Our Facebook page is at Westworld Podcast. If you like us, add us on iTunes, leave us a review. That's how we get noticed. Before we move on, we'd like to give a shout out to some listeners that have emailed us at HBOWestworldPodcast@gmail.com with some pretty insightful theories and thoughts, notably Gabby from Homebase Mom, Joshua Sosa, Christina from Ohio, and John G. We'd like to try and address some of these letters if we have time later on in the show. This episode was written by Suzanne Werbel and Lisa Joy, and it was directed by Jennifer Getzinger. Dwayne, why don't you hit us up with a recap of this episode before we jump into the analysis?
All right, Decoherence. So we meet Maeve in a construct of a bucolic pasture that Serac created. Serac shows up and he says if she fails him again, he'll effectively put her in purgatory. Maeve wants help to achieve the quest, and Serac agrees. Maeve wakes up in the World War II Winter Line scenario and single-handedly takes on the Italian army in hand-to-hand combat, in heels, a pencil skirt, and full makeup without breaking a sweat, because she's incredible. She meets Sizemore afterwards, and she talks with him in a bar, where she perceives that she's been moved to a facility within Delos Corporation headquarters. The tech team over on Delos Island, where the parks are, transfers a copy of Hector over, and Maeve manages to restore Hector to his awakened self. Rehoboam shows a divergence visualization that mentions San Francisco. The graph is very skewed to the left. We find the man in black dressed in white as he attends a group therapy session, where we learn that he has no delusions about the state of the world and the fact that he killed his daughter because he was confused at the time. As he says this, his therapist learns that her husband is leaving her because of her insight profile. She kills herself. Later, the man in black, which we'll call William from now on, gets a blood panel and is forced to receive an implant for augmented reality therapy. His blood contains a protein that causes problems for the computer system that analyzes it, and it causes the system to send a beacon regarding his whereabouts. A doctor named Alpert administers augmented reality treatment to William, who's then reminded of being in an abusive situation as a boy and becomes agitated. The doctor and an orderly try to sedate him, and he bites off the orderly's finger. Later, William is brought to a quote-unquote group therapy session that includes multiple versions of himself at stages of his life, as well as his father-in-law, James Delos, playing the role of the therapist. It seems to be a hallucination. William is confronted with the fact that he was a problematic child that may have driven his father to drink, rather than the other scenario, which was he was a problem child because his father drank. The idea is that he's always had an evil streak. And there in the virtual group session or hallucination, the William we see in white, in the white suit of a mental patient, brutally kills all the other versions of himself. Meanwhile, Hale and her son head to the child's father's place amid post-insight disclosure chaos in San Francisco. The news shows how the chaos is happening worldwide with riots and so on. Her ex-husband has not read the profile because he believes it's their choice that determines the future, not a machine, not Rehoboam. Hale leaves the child with the husband, and she goes into the office and meets up with a board member. He relates to her that they can fend off Serac's takeover. As they walk into the office, two landscapers come up to them and assassinate the board member on Serac's orders. Serac, still on his plane, calls Hale to let her know that he interfered. Serac then lands and takes over the Delos company, commanding that over $1 trillion in Delos intellectual property be destroyed, namely all assets but the ones he's interested in keeping. He has everyone tested to see if they're hosts. And Serac looks at his watch and notices that the Rehoboam divergence is getting smaller. Hale sneaks away and backs up the data Serac once destroyed, and that Dolores wants for her plans. In doing so, Hale kills a coworker to keep that secret. After uploading the assets to an offsite cloud server, Hale uses the console to find William, the man in black, and pass that information onto to another Dolores. When she's on the screen, she notices that a new Maeve is being printed at the facility, along with a few other hosts. She relates that they have recovered, Serac has recovered Connell's head control unit from the explosion. Hale goes to her safe and retrieves a gun and a canister. She calls her son's father and tells him that she'll be back in half an hour. Hale's intercepted and told to attend a board meeting, where Serac blows up her spot and says to tell everybody that she's Dolores in front of the entire board. Hale gasses the room, disables everyone but Serac, and turns out to be a projection. He calls all of his resources to take out Hale. Back in the mental institution, Bernard and Stubbs find William and help him escape before Dolores can get to him. Serac's people copy the recovered Dolores into the simulation that Maeve is in, so that Maeve can connect with Dolores, talk to her, figure out what she needs, what she wants. She wants to better understand Dolores in order to kill her if she has to. The two speak, and during the discussion, Hale finds out where the head control units are, and she destroys Hector. Before she can get to Maeve, a tactical team comes and assaults the area. Just as Hale is about to be captured, she activates the riot mech and uses it to escape. She makes it to her son and his father, and as they drive away, the vehicle that they're all in explodes, seemingly on someone's orders. While Hale's husband and son are definitely dead, she escapes, crawling from the wreckage, burned, broken, and seething.
Yes, what a great last shot. Like, I've never seen so much rage in the eyes of a character as Hale.
Of a bald-ass robot?
Yes.
Other than, like, a Terminator, right?
Right, so I definitely have a salient point about Terminators, but let's talk about our initial impressions.
Yeah, so I thought this was one of the best episodes of the series total. This is right up there with some of the best ones in season 1 and 2. I can't remember offhand. Riddle of the Sphinx, I guess, would be one, or The Passenger. It's really good. I think that this episode had a terrific balance of dramatic conflict and action that is relevant to the plot, not just action for action's sake.
Yes. Right? Yes, last week felt like it had action for action's sake, and this week the action felt real. I mean, I also really want to understand what's going on with that gun that Hale had. I mean, the amount of bullets in that thing was incredible. It was like automatic, semi-automatic or whatever. It was crazy.
And so many different points in this episode felt like they were fan service love letters. Like,
give one of those points, yeah.
Like William confronting all of the other versions of himself, including young William. And
young adult William,
as opposed to child William, who I'm calling child William. And we get Hector back again, and Lee Sizemore, and Maeve, and we see this badass riot control mech, a battle. I mean, it's like this episode is written for fans of Westworld. I feel like.
There were a couple of things I didn't get. Like, I didn't get why she had to beat up all the Italian guys in the beginning. Right. Like, okay.
Yeah, that was a little...
I was like, okay, thanks.
The Matrix training scene? That one?
Yeah, the Matrix training scene. There's another bit of the Matrix in here that I thought was interesting. Some character choices seemed a little off to me, but otherwise it was solid movement forward in the plot, and it felt like the way the plot should be moving forward. Mm-hmm. The choices that seemed off to me were... there was a doctor who killed herself, and I was like, okay, whatever. There was a board member who randomly was like, I'm telling Serac on you, which is like weird considering Serac is hostily taking over the board and nobody likes him. And then there was this awesome line.
I thought that was one of Serac's guys.
No,
because he had like a French accent.
Did he have a French accent?
It sounded like it.
I assumed it was Serac's guy, actually.
I mean... And I don't know how Serac's guys know the lay of the land in this place anyway. But yeah, it just seemed a little strange. But and there's one line, like, you hold the key to the sublime, which is Maeve talking to the McConnell's copy of Dolores. Mm-hmm. That's a little confusing. And she's talking about how, like, Dolores holds the key to the outside, the heaven place where her daughter is. And it was a cool line. It just seemed really out of place. But that said, they're really trying to pack every aspect, every second, every minute with content that is like rich. And I can't help but appreciate that. So
I think that's the benefit really of what's going on here. That's the benefit of an 8-episode season as opposed to a 10-episode season.
I think 5 might have been too short, but I would say that for my part, I've really been enjoying series that don't that, that, that that don't feel like they have to stretch out. And I know there's some pushback in the industry because writers like a 22-episode season. It's just what they like. They want to be paid for that many months and all that stuff, and I get that. But I think content suffers when it's stretched out. And the idea of a season being a novella instead of a novel, I'm all about it.
Yeah, maybe I'm kind of in the middle or maybe even less than Dwayne. I thought it was a decent episode. I thought, you know, some of the action beats were okay. Some of the initial action was pretty rough, to be honest.
Like what? What was pretty rough?
Like you talked about that initial action scene. It just did not feel very sort of fluid. I think mm-hmm. the action scenes later with Maeve felt a lot more crisp and well put together and constructed. I think that, you know, the episode did move forward pretty well, and it was good seeing I think that the cuts were smartly done. But I do think that the mystery of Dolores being in all these copies and things of that nature were just much more enlightened and more sort of vital and interesting to me than an episode of this nature. But, you know, I think it was decent. Not bad.
I'm glad we got to see Bernard and Stubbs because I forgot that they existed.
Right. So, right. We had a little break from them for a little bit. All right, let's talk about some of the salient points of this episode. Tosin, why don't you hit us up with what you feel like the title means, decoherence?
Well, one definition of decoherence is a physics definition. It's the study of interactions between a quantum system, generally one with very small number of microscopic particles, like electrons, atoms, etc., and the larger macroscopic environment. So it's just how these interact and play together. One example that you see within this episode is when Delos is talking to the man in white, formerly known as the man in black.
Right.
And when he says, it's not all about you, you know, when he's telling him to stop interrupting.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of shows that, you know, it is the sum of all parts. He is just one character, one role in here. But we see it a little bit more throughout this episode. We see it with the virus that we'll talk a little bit more about and how it seeps in and infects the rest of the system and gives them more access. We see Maeve being sort of that fly in the ointment of Sorok's mm-hmm, plans. Mm-hmm. We see these different little seismic activities that Riho has noted appearing in different regions and how they interact with the greater ellipse that we might see, or the journey that the world may actually be for good or for bad.
Yeah, I tried to connect the idea of this title to the concept of quantum decoherence, and I couldn't make that connection, the connection that you did. But on just the basic level, what I came up with, that coherence is defined as the state of things holding together firmly. So decoherence would be the state of those things falling apart. Basically chaos, which is what happens in this episode, is a lot of chaos.
I mean, the word chaos is used multiple times in the episode.
Right.
Like, I don't know if the word chaos is used more in this episode or in the entire season of The Witcher. I'm just saying, it was used a lot.
I just wanted to make a note that when the Connelloris pearl is connected to the system, the War World simulation with Maeve and Hector and Lee Sizemore, and Haloris pulls that interface up to view that, she also notes that it has corruption in its data. That pearl has corruption in its data. I don't know if that's going to come up again, but she does take that pearl with her when she leaves the Delos R&D department. So,
and it's also worth noting that corruption in data, it's an aspect of decoherence of written data,
mm-hmm.
right? Like when you rub a magnet on an old hard disk drive,
right?
You know, you're creating decoherence. You're literally moving the electrons with your magnet. And that is causing the data to get corrupted. you know, it's decohering. Yeah, that's a whole thing. One thing I wanted to mention was William and mental illness. William talks about how he doesn't have any delusions about what happened to his daughter. He knows he killed her. He doesn't make excuses about it other than the fact that he was in the park and he was confused. And he doesn't really have a lot of delusions about his life, you know, before and where his life is headed now. He's like, I know what I have to do and things. And the big thing was there's a scene in the normal group therapy session where he talks about the destruction of the planet.
Right.
And the fact that humanity is cancer. And, you know, I hear that. And I thought that the person crying after he said that felt a little cliche. Because, I mean, as much as I don't know that I believe everything that he's saying.
Yeah.
You know, like, humans are destroying the planet and he's just saying it.
I think right?
there's a raw truth to it, which
sure.
I think a lot of people don't want to hear. I mean, I can imagine saying something like that. I remember there's a show on HBO called The Newsroom, and one of the iconic moments at the beginning is some Q&A session with a bunch of students, and somebody says something about America being the best, and, you know, the main character, Jeff Daniels. He basically lays out a monologue about how the U.S. is not the best, and everyone's really taken aback. But the thing is, he's laying out facts. And when you lay out facts like that, people are often taken aback because of how you deliver them or the fact that you're bold enough to say them. But what we see in both of those situations is a person who is more – who's heavily based in realism. The way they see the world is the way they see the world, and they don't use many of the delusions that a lot of us use in order to kind of – make the stories around our lives that make our lives worth living, so to speak. So according to Neil Burton at writing for Psychology Today, he says that while people with depression can suffer from cognitive distortions, the scientific literature suggests that those with only mild to moderate depression can also have more accurate judgment about the outcome of so-called contingent events, which may or may not occur, and a more realistic perception of their role, abilities, and limitations. This so-called depressive realism may enable a person with depression to shed the Pollyanna optimism and rose-tinted spectacles that shield most of us from reality, to see life more accurately and to judge it accordingly.
Mm.
Right? So all that's to say that I think William, as we've seen, definitely shows signs of like depression throughout the whole show, right? Like he can't exist in the normal world. It's you know, he's done a lot for the world, but he's super cynical about it. He can't achieve joy. He can't have any enjoyment over there, not even from his family. And when he's in Westworld, at least he can kind of like run amok, and that's the sort of like you know, rose-tinted place for him. So I just wanted to bring that up there because he's in a mental facility.
Yeah,
he's a person who's got obviously, like, as an audience member, you question his. You know, his sanity
sure.
a lot of the show, right? So I just thought it was worth bringing that up. So yeah, that's where I wanted to go with that. And I also wanted to bring up one more thing mm-hmm. about it. This is a quote that will come back later in the show, but William says, if you can't tell, does it matter? Right?
Right.
And he's kind of talking about his life and like his role in it. And we'll get into that later more deeply. But I wanted to bring up that's one of the things that was said in season two when we see the way that the Delos Corporation or the Westworld Corporation by Ford and Arnold is being sold to Delos's son. The idea that like these robots. You know, I think it's Angela who says it
says it to William in season one, episode two. Also, when they're in the loadout room,
in the loadout room, right. The idea being, if you can't tell, doesn't matter. So, as just a salient point, it's good continuity there.
Absolutely.
There's kind of another quote that William says that I thought was really interesting and kind of poignant, and that's when he says humanity is a thin layer of bacteria in the ball of mud hurtling through the void. And
that's that realism, you know, right? That's that super realism that like people don't want to hear.
And, you know, it's kind of, he also later on goes to saying like paradise that we all used up, kind of talking about like humankind as being a sort of disease or virus. And I'll play a little bit more about that later, but it it's unique thinking about that when you think about both Dolores and Maeve, as well as any of the other, you know, AI in here, is, you know, what is their role in here? Are they the cleansers? Are they, you know,
or is Rehobo, outsiders, right,
looking in? Yeah, like where does, like, you know, if humankind is this petri dish,
sure,
like, then who is really the person who's, you know, playing around with this? And then
I think it's worth thinking about. Oh, sorry, go ahead. Sorry,
oh, no, go ahead.
I was gonna say it's worth thinking about Rehoboam as kind of a huge white blood cell, right? That's just here to like clean up humanity in some level. And as you've seen with the disclosures of people's insight profiles, that cleaning up usually involves killing them between 5 and 8 years. By like, yeah, suicide or something, right? So there's something there. But I definitely like, I like where you're going with this. The idea that paradise is all used up, I think it resonates now because this show takes place like 30 years from now, and you know, we're at a critical place where we need to think about what we're going to do to change the way we live in order to make sure that the what's left of paradise can remain, and that perhaps even we can turn some of what we've destroyed back into paradise. And that's something that, you know, obviously there's a lot of like political debate about, yeah, it, and there's a lot of like, you know,
yeah,
discussion about how realistic the science is and stuff like that. But the world they're living in is one where William feels, you know, that it's, we destroyed it. And so that's definitely worth, you know, I think it's there for us to think about today, which is what good science fiction is supposed, right, to do.
I was just going to, I just wanted to add on to all of this that since this season we're talking a lot about the connections to the Matrix, there was a line in the Matrix where Agent Smith is talking to, I think, Morpheus, and he says,
"Every mammal on this planet instinctively develops a natural equilibrium with the surrounding environment, but you humans do not. You move to an area and you multiply. And multiply until every natural resource is consumed. There is another organism on this planet that follows the same pattern, a virus. Human beings are a disease, a cancer of this planet. You are a plague, and we are the cure."
Yeah. Which
kind I was of totally going to go there. I'm so glad you did.
Right?
No, I mean, this talk of humankind being like a virus,
yeah,
kind of shows a little bit throughout this episode. We see William missing pieces of his fingers, right? Like as though something has eaten away at him.
Mm-hmm.
William has that virus that was injected in him by may infect the entire system. Really, and then they even noted that it's a protein in the mix. And, you know, I think as we kind of look through this and we see like humankind being viruses and potentially the AI or the system being the ones to clean up, even Dolores goes to Maeve, "Hey, you're not the villain and neither am I. We are survivors, right? We are that other link in there that, you know, will outlast whatever is killing humankind there." But I think one thing that's also kind of interesting when we look back at the note of paradise, you know, there's that concept of Adam and Eve going out and Adam and Eve being this sort of pair that maybe has fallen but has found that light. We've got several pairs in this series. You know, who is really that representation of Adam and Eve? Is it, you know, Dolores and her gang? Is it Maeve and someone else who's there to help her? Is it, you know, Stubbs and Bernard? Is it Man in Black? Like, I think there's several pairs of people that could potentially represent this this new existence. So,
oh, that's an interesting point. I will have to. I'm curious as to see how all that shakes out. Round up the discussion about William and his psychoses. I noticed that when we first look at go into William's regression of his childhood experiences, and we think that his father is shouting at him because his father is abusive and might be going to abuse him, we see him reading this Arthurian tale, which sort of syncs up to the legend that he spoke about himself, both indirectly in this episode, and I think he also talked about it in other episodes in season one that, you know, he liked to read stories, and these are like the stories that he this is all about, losing himself in a book, right? So the book that he's reading, it's a book of Arthurian legends, and the story he's reading specifically is one called Sir Rowan and Lady Sulon. Well, that story doesn't actually exist in
So you do pause to look at things.
I did
too.
In this case.
Yeah, okay. Because they
froze it on the page, and I'm like, something's going on there. So I froze on the page.
It's a fake one.
Looked it up. It's a fake one. And I think that is to indicate to us as an audience that William's memory of his childhood experiences is unreliable, as we see when we jump back to that memory later on during the group session, and we realize that his father isn't upset at him because his father is abusive. His father is upset at him because William is egregiously abusive to another child. You know, breaking his arm.
Although I would say that I could see some psychiatrists and psychologists saying that the father's reaction toward William was really borderline abusive.
Like, sure. But I think again,
there's something there.
Looking
like
at
it, the fact is that the kid was such a problem that it drove the father to drink. It wasn't like the kid had a father who drank and
right.
was a jerk.
Right.
You know, he was so abusive that people
right.
are like, no, you drove him to drink. That's what's going on. I say this as I have a Balvenie in front of me and two children asleep.
Yes, but But the point is, William's memory is at fault. He's sort of created this illusion of this legend of who he was that doesn't jibe with reality.
Yeah, and that falls away, right? So part of him is super realistic, and then in his kind of self-made backstory, there's a part of him who clings to a lie that makes the world more convenient.
Yes.
And frankly, when you're a person of note, sometimes the story of your childhood isn't even yours to tell, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at, you know, like Malcolm Gladwell tells stories about Bill Gates when he was young. It's unclear to me how much Malcolm Gladwell got those stories from talking to Bill Gates, from talking to his parents, from talking to his teachers.
Mm.
But the story that Malcolm Gladwell puts together is one that says something about Bill Gates that actually may or may not be true, because the story alludes to his motivations. And so it's interesting, because if you're a person of note and people want to know, you know, the whole like game of storytelling is like, how did this person get so far in life?
Right.
And so on and so forth. So there might be aspects of William's story that he doesn't even, you know, that he's bought into that
sure.
may not even be his invention. So one thing I wanted to also bring up was, speaking of old stories, there's this moment, right? So Hale activates the mech.
Yeah.
And the mech comes out and takes out people. And then the camera cuts, and she kind of bursts through the door, and she's kind of trying to escape, right, with some bullets in her and stuff. And she's doing this very specific limp.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back to 1982 or 84 when the Terminator came out, the original one, it looks almost exactly like the limp that the naked Terminator machine is doing after its skin has been all burned off and stuff like that. And it's going after Sarah Connor before she crushes it in the vice press or whatever. It's also similar to Terminator 2, 1992, when Sarah Connor is limping and telling John to get the hell out of there. It's this kind of like run, drag your leg thing. And to me, that was really cool, because at the end of the episode, as we spoke about already, Hale, she's burned up, not unlike the Terminator in the first Terminator
movie. Mm-hmm.
So she's doing the Terminator limp, let's call it, if it's a dance. And at the end, they didn't go full on, here's your bald, you know, here's your endoskeleton, but they pretty much like took her there. Like, here's the explosion, here's how the robot comes out afterwards. It was very like, in my head, I heard like, dun 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 dun. Like as she was breaking out of that car. So that was pretty cool. Also, speaking of old stories, so Terminator, let's go back to Star Trek: The Next Generation. There must be some holodeck level projection, because Hale's a robot, and she thought Sir Rock was there enough to spend a bullet on him.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, Hale has all the... She doesn't have, like, super powers as a robot. She's just, you know, in a human-like host, so I think... I don't think she has...
I think that robot vision...
Super vision.
And, you know...
I don't think she has robot... I mean... But well, I will I mean, say...
Well, I'm saying there's two things. So one, robots have, like, the whole mesh network thing anyway, right?
In the park.
So if you got a mesh network, which means you're pushing out Bluetooth or whatever...
In the park. You know, in the park, I mean, in the they park, have a mesh network. The host.
Well, the mesh network just means the actual host is part of the network. That means you broadcast. That's what a mesh network
sure.
is. The device broadcast.
Sure.
So I think they all broadcast. So, like, you know, if there's a person in front of you, whatever you're pushing out there, it's going to get blocked by all the juice that's in a person. I'm just saying, it was just weird to me that she didn't recognize yeah. that Ciroc was not there.
I don't think right? the hosts outside of the Westworld Park, the hosts that were created in our real world, have that same mesh network ability. That
I think they all have the mesh network.
I mean, I don't know. Where's your evidence?
Specs for a host are the specs for a host. Like, I don't see Dolores being like, well, I'm just going to remove this spec over here and that spec. And
that's a good speculation, I would say. But I will say that Ciroc is, you know, the head of a tech company. If he doesn't have, like, holodeck level projection ability, I don't know who would. You know, this is a...
The thing is, a holodeck requires that the space you're in has holographic projectors. It's not like you put a projector, you know, like you bring a projector in a briefcase and you splay it across a wall, and that's how you get a 3D projection that convinces people.
No, I hear what you're saying.
The building has to have... So sure. How does he do that when he just walks in the building?
Imagine that Ciroc may actually be there, but for that particular meeting when he knew he was going to confront her, he used the projection, right?
Yeah.
He may actually, yeah. because they could have landed that ship, and at that point, she's the most vulnerable. She's not necessarily thinking.
Yeah, like, maybe. I guess it just threw me off that.
Family. Sure. Yeah. And we've actually seen in this very conference room where they're at, this board meeting room, we've actually seen projections being used. In episode one of this season, where Charlotte is at the board meeting, some of the other members are projecting themselves.
Last thing I'll say was that it's interesting to me that Delos Corp, which is all about recreating your mind without your body, so once yeah. your body dies, they have a copy of your mind. But whether we're looking at Hale or others, Hale specifically shows that your mind informs your body, right? Also with, like, Musashi, right? So, like, Musashi, you know, it was Dolores inside Musashi's body. Yeah, Musashi was powerful enough to take down Maeve, even though Dolores sure. has never practiced with the sword at all, right? So these bodies have some chutzpah, some stuff going on inside of them that no matter which brain ball you put in there, the body has memory, it has the feelings, whatever, right? Yeah. So Hale feels close to her son, even though she's actually Dolores. But there's so if you read like 1491 and some other things, there's some interesting pre-Columbian beliefs that shows that your mind informs your body. So the Western understanding of sort of like your soul being separate from your body never worked for many cultures here, including like the Lakono Arawak, which are from the native country that my parents are from.
Sure.
And what was interesting to me is this idea that despite the fact that Delos is trying to separate minds from bodies and kind of like make hosts again, and sort of like someone could be ostensibly immortal, there's a problem in that your body affects your mind. And maybe maybe that's one of the issues that happens when you take a human and you try to put them into a host body. Right? Every time they try to do that, it doesn't seem to work.
Right.
So maybe one of the reasons why is because those minds don't fit those bodies.
And I think also that ties into the larger themes that we're exploring in this episode about Dolores duplicating herself into other copies, and those copies independently.
Are not Dolores.
Yes, they start to grow independently from Dolores Prime to be their own person informed perhaps by the bodies that they're in.
I mean, in so much as. Hale says so in that first episode. Like she's like, second episode. She's like, I am not who I thought I'd be.
Let's discuss some unanswered questions we have about this episode. First of all, let's do a little Pearl roll call. a little change here. We still have Bernard, the Red Pearl. Dolores Hale, at the end of this episode, is still kicking, is still like Terminator 2-ing it, you know, like rising from the ashes. Dolores Connell's Connelloris has been revived and is in the data has been corrupted, but is still out there. Hale took Connell's pearl with her when she left Delos, right? Did I read that correctly?
So I think she did. Okay, so she puts it in her purse, yeah. Right?
Well, but no, she left her purse in the boardroom, but she
she gets it later. She gets it after the boardroom when she goes into the third floor R&D facility and crushes Hector's HCU. Then she grabs Dolores Connell's HCU and she seems to get out of there. But her outfit doesn't have any pockets. We just have to assume she had it with her and she had it with her in a way where it didn't get
destroyed. You don't want to know where she hid it.
Yeah, well, if she can fit a gun like her pants, I'm sure she can pop the pearl in her bra or something.
We still don't know the status of Dolores Musashi.
Right. So we know he was victorious against Maeve.
Yep.
And then, again, despite the fact that she didn't really have any training.
And then skedaddled.
But we don't know where he is now.
Yeah. And then we still do not have a verification of who is in that last pearl. Now, Dwayne, you have a theory that I don't particularly agree with, but let's talk it out.
I just thought that we see in this episode we see Major Craddock shows up again, and he walks the Man in Black, William, over to his quote unquote. Like his hallucination group session. And the question is, on some level, Craddock was a host.
Sure.
And it could be that he's a Dolores too. That said, it could be that he was a figment of the Man in Black's imagination, although one has to wonder why he was thinking of him. Now, part of the things you have to think also are Hale was like, hey, we found the Man in Black because of the thing we put in his blood. And if Dolores was Craddock, you'd think he'd get the Man in Black out of there. But he didn't. Instead, Stubbs and Bernard got the Man in Black out of there. So,
yeah,
I don't know. You're saying that, Major Craddock could be a Dolores?
Sure. But that assumes the part of the theory that the everything that the Man in Black that William experienced in the group therapy session was not a hallucination, but some sort of AR therapy or something. And I think that it's his psychosis rearing up again, the way it did when his daughter confronted him in his estate earlier this season. That was just sort of a figment of his imagination. So I think him confronting all the other versions of himself was a figment of his imagination, of his psychosis, rather than an AR experience that was crafted for him.
I never said it was an AR experience.
Right, but the assumption that Major Craddock was an actual, physical being who led him to this AR therapy room also assumes that he never left led him to the group therapy room, assumes that he never left the AR therapy room. And I believe he never left the AR therapy room, because that's where we last saw him before this spate of hallucinations in the group therapy room. And that's where we find him again when Bernard and Stubbs come and find him.
Yeah, it's pretty confusing. But yeah, I'm just putting it out there.
Sure. Absolutely. Anything's possible.
Right, Andy, you had a question, right, Andy?
Yeah. So my question is, if Hector's data was transferred electronically from Westworld to a local blank pearl at Delos headquarters, R&D department, does the original Hector pearl still exist in Westworld? In other words, is Hector still, is his soul, his being still alive?
Yeah, I think he's not, to be honest.
Well, it all depends, right? So they said something like, and you have this quote, Andy, something like, all right, take his situation to the place so they can transfer, destroy everything else. So it's unclear whether or not like they destroyed the content after they copied it and they transferred the copy over.
Yeah.
Or whether it's sitting there on a desk somewhere, right? I mean, it could be, but it's just it's unclear right now. His fate hangs in the balance.
His fate does hang. Yeah.
But, I think that when it comes to copying, it's pretty established that like a copy does not destroy the original because it's a copy.
Right. Now I would have thought so before season three, but after this whole thing with all the Doloreses, like I don't even know what to think anymore.
Well, I like the idea that a copy doesn't destroy the original because that's how a copy is supposed to be.
Sure.
I agree, but I sort of feel like Maeve's reaction, if I'm going to take Maeve's reaction at heart, it felt like she had truly finally lost someone that she cared about.
Well, she just got him back.
But, you know,
she has no access to get him again, right?
That's true.
I guess. So she doesn't know how she'll get him back. And she doesn't know that there's maybe another version of him in Westworld. She just knows that she had him. She had her guy again, her Adam to her Eve, as you would say, Tosin. And then she lost him right there. And she lost him just like, I don't know if you guys remember The Matrix, there's this moment where Cypher, who's played by Joe Pantolone?
Joey Pants.
Yeah, Joe Pants. anyway, there's this moment in The Matrix where he's on the phone with everybody who's inside The Matrix, and he's like, hey, man, they're going to wipe my memory, and I'm going to get stakes, Anthony. I'm going to get stakes, whatever. And I'm going back in, baby, and you guys are all screwed. And he pulls out Apoc's thing, and Apoc dies. And then there's a moment where they look at Switch, and he's like, if you got something to say, Switch, say it now. And Switch looks at everyone and says, like, not like this. And then he pulls it out, and her eyes roll up, and she dies. And it's like, that's fucked up, right?
Yep.
That's exactly what happened with Hector there. And all I could think about was like, not like this, not like this. Yep.
Lots of Matrix connections this season.
I know, it's really interesting. So, you know, rather than say you guys should do The Matrix, I went out and found that exact scene on YouTube and I have linked it.
Nice.
Because it's an icon. Like, I don't know. I saw The Matrix, obviously, when it came out, like, back in 99. But that one scene, I mean, that actress has, like, two lines in the whole movie. And that one stuck with me the whole time.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's a terrible way to go. I don't want to go like that.
Kind of continuing on that train of thought of how Hector's data was transferred, I was kind of curious, did they really tell you how they managed to move Maeve and those other hosts into Delos HQ? It's a company that at the time Serac still didn't completely own. It seemed odd to me that they were already there and making copies.
I assumed that from the moment Serac landed, they
had a whole team of people, and he's like, you guys know what to do.
Right.
And so some people were like, okay, I'm hearing Serac's orders to do this, and I'm hearing Serac's orders to do that, and this. And if that's your contention, then the whole holodeck inside the boardroom makes more sense. But I see why what you're asking. What I don't get is how, suppose they had a team in there, right? They had a team to set up the stuff to put Maeve's brain ball in her body. At what
point they're there moving, and observe, right?
Well, when they're moving Maeve, right? So Maeve's in the construct of the War World Winter Line thing.
Yeah.
And so they've got some portable system keeping that construct happening, and then they're able to move her, and all you see is a shimmer. It's not like they turned it off and turned it back on.
That was the one weird thing for me, is like, what did Serac bring with him that is a portable War World simulation that Maeve's Pearl is like chugging along in, that he's able to like move it to the R&D level.
I mean, that's like we didn't see. Laptop must be using AMD Ryzen.
But maybe the real world simulation is so small that it'll fit like on a laptop in the future. Who knows?
Yeah. It was unclear. It was also unclear how they could kind of hot swap thing, you know, without her really noticing it. But also they moved that system into the R&D third floor.
Yeah.
And yet, unlike in Serac's personal computer lab or whatever, Maeve was still able to see outside.
At the point where she uncovers what Conaloris is doing, she grabs a pad and looks at the R&D lab from one of the pads. However, before that, she sort of magically has this vision of what's outside the world. And I don't know whether that is because she's tied into the system and has sort of superseded control over the system. Because, you know, at one point, before that point, she kind of can see that stuff. And then she says, I need more access. She grabs a pad and then she visually sees on the pad a camera output, a camera feed from R&D room. So that's a good question.
Still don't understand the extent of her powers.
Yeah, it sounds like in the Serac lab, she was able to effectively like bring the entire simulation computer to a halt.
Yeah.
And use that moment to, this is back when I was talking about how she and Dolores can both write code in real time, and she found a vulnerability and she hacked her way into that lab's closed circuit camera system.
Yeah.
So we have to, I guess, assume that when they moved the whole system over to the R&D lab at Delos, she was able to use that hack? It's just weird. It's a weird thing.
It's a little weird. It's a little convenient, right?
Yeah, it was a little convenient. So
I mean, I'm not going to hate on it.
Speaking of convenient.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some jewelry.
Yeah. So when Hale Oris is being confronted by Serac in the boardroom, and just before Hale Oris has her purse taken from her and the contents voided of it, including the gas canister, Hale takes the bracelet off her wrist and puts it into her purse. And there are very specific cutaways that show that this is happening. But then we don't see anything about that. After
like
that,
a fake Chekhov's gun.
Yeah, so it is. Well, but I think maybe it's a Chekhov's gun that will play out
next episode.
In the next episode. But I don't know if you guys had any clearer idea of why she did that, other than maybe it's just laying some ground for future episodes.
My first thought was like, girl needs to like stretch out so she can kick some ass. And that bracelet, I mean, it was not a comfortable, it's like a slap bracelet. Like nobody wants to wear that, right?
You know what I will say though is her outfit was amazing. That whole like suit
she's
thing.
She's worn it before too, which is weird.
Yeah. I mean, it was just like, I've never seen anything like that. For women's fashion, she was, you know, she was, that stuff was tight.
It was literally tight. Remarkably, that's
one way you could look at it.
That suit is actually available today. You could buy that suit today.
Is it?
So,
oh, cool. Mm-hmm. One way you could also look at it is that, typically she's one of the things that holds her back is that sort of connection and how she feels. She's always looking at her wrist. She's always holding on to it and thinking what's in turn. And there she's like untethering herself and then goes into machine mode where she just destroys everyone.
Like, Tosin,
I got to be super robot now as opposed to I got to be like,
I think you're on to something. I think that probably psychologically ties into her untethering herself from her apprehension.
Hey, I think you do have something because my suggestion that it was about like she's got to get comfortable so she can kick ass. Between her and Maeve and Dolores, they kill a lot of people with heels on, so a bracelet shouldn't get in the way.
Dwayne, you had a question about another question about Serac.
Serac mentions these violent delights have violent ends.
Yeah.
When he confronts Hale, in that room. And we kind of have to wonder, like Serac's been playing the long game over so many, like what, 20 years or something?
Yep, 20 years.
He's been buying pieces of the company. He's been using Rehoboam since the beginning. Like he plays a very long game. Could it be that part of his acquisition strategy was to activate the hosts so that they gained this kind of, they had the opportunity to gain sanctions. And then, Dolores, having gone through what she did, she was like the one to get there. Right. I don't know. It just seemed very specific for him to mention that one line of code. Also we know that he worked with Hale to get Abernathy to hold all this intellectual property, right? So, which is also funny because he's like, destroy everything. But at the same time, he's working with real Hale before to use Abernathy's head control unit to transfer out, like, you know, presumably hundreds of millions of dollars in code and IP and stuff like that. And Abernathy had these Violent Delights at the Violent Ends kind of bug in him. So whether that was a spontaneous bug of Abernathy's that kind of transmitted from person to person, we don't know. We thought so, but, you know, the fact that Serac knows it, maybe he had something to do with it, and maybe he got Hale to introduce it. I don't know. It bugged me.
It's a great question. Like, I have no idea how he would know that, other than it being sort of metatextually relevant to the series. But yeah, I mean, the only thing I could think of speculate in that regard is that Serac has a working knowledge of the massacre at Westworld and all of the things that led to that. So maybe there was some documentation about the Violent Delights phrase somewhere there. Who knows? But your guess is just as good. You know, maybe he did plant the virus. Who knows?
Because what we're finding out is that, I mean, we've been asking, is Dolores the bad guy? Is Serac the good guy? What makes the season actually quite interesting is that everyone believes they're the good guy, right?
Right. Right. Lots of gray areas. No one's black or white.
It's kind of like, you know, right. I mean, I think they're all pretty black. They're all pretty bad. But they all think they're the good guy. That's the interesting thing. Kind of like the, you know, like activists for different causes all think that they're the good people. You know, they're the good people. So there's that. Now, one thing, I mentioned earlier how the doctor killed herself, and, you know, it was a little surprising to me. I don't really understand why more people aren't in denial about the Rehoboam predictions profile, insight profile thing. The one person we've heard who said, I'm not into it, was
Jake,
you know, Hale's husband, who's like, yeah, you know, I don't think a machine chooses, I think we choose. But the whole society is completely falling apart because they read some prediction from a computer. Like, I gotta say, that just doesn't sound, I mean, it's 30 years from now, but that doesn't sound like the humanity I know. Like, we're in a place right now where people are confronted with the fact that if they carry on life as normal, they could get sick and die, you know? And, you know, there are quite a few people who are like, that sounds like poppycock to me. I'm going to protest the fact that I have to stay at home. You know what I mean?
But
like, I don't see, first of all, everybody has a bad outcome. Every single Rehoboam inside profile we've seen
that we've seen.
Everyone has a bad outcome that we've seen. So that's one. And two, they all believe them. So I guess, yeah, it just, you know, I guess it's a TV show. And TV shows need to have drama. And that's part of the drama.
Sure.
But at the same time, it just seems strange to me that, like, they're, like, with the exception of one person, Hale's husband or ex-husband, there is, you know, nobody's questioning these outcomes. No one is believing in the fundamental thing that I think most, especially Americans, believe in, that they're in control of their own destiny.
Sure.
So that to me is a question that's more existential. But
I think you hit upon a key thing when you said 30 years. So imagine an entire generation who have been instituted into believing that Rehoboam will lead them to their better future. So they've got this ingrained in their mind that Rehoboam speaks the truth, that its algorithm, based on their own data, leads them to their inevitable path,
destiny, loop, whatever.
Yeah,
yeah. So I mean, I just don't know. I just, it's, you know, it's one of those things that's like, you know.
So when that's taken, or not taken away from them, but when that is revealed that they're, that these things that are on their path that are inevitable, that they're facing, are terrible, terrible choices that they are they have to face. But my whole question thought about that is that not like a self-fulfilling prophecy when they see that stuff is inevitable? Then in reacting to it by killing yourself or other chaotic reactions. Doesn't that counter the prophecy?
Yeah, we call that stereotype threat. So like this idea that like if you're from a population that's been stereotyped to do a certain thing,
yeah,
you tend to be okay with doing that thing on some level, right? So, you know, if people say your population enjoys fried chicken, you're like, there's no taboo in me enjoying fried chicken, that kind of thing. So that could be a thing. But I feel like personally for me, and I don't know about you guys, but personally for me, if I saw some prediction that I was going to do something bad, you know, have an affair or whatever, I feel like I'd be on the lookout for the opportunity to have the affair and then not do it and be like, I dodged that bullet.
Yeah.
The system said, hey, there's a flag here. Watch out. And then when it showed up, I'd be prepared for it.
Yeah.
Well, and my judgment would be, you know, more, I guess, ego instead of id, you know, super ego instead of id. And I would have been like, yeah, I'm going to avoid that and just get around it. But here, I guess what I'm frustrated at is everyone's like, oh, it said this thing is going to happen. I guess it's going to happen. I'm going to act out.
Yeah, it does seem a little far-fetched to believe that they would accept their fates as written in stone. And I think maybe the more logical reaction is Jake's reaction, which is like, you know, this kind of stuff doesn't tell me who I'm going to be.
Right, I know who I am. My mama raised me.
Yeah.
You know, where's that aspect? Also, wouldn't we all get on social media? Like, you know, your close friends, your very close friends.
Yeah.
You know, the three of us would be hanging out and be like, hey, dude, Insight said I'm going to do this. And you're like, Insight said I'm going to do this too, or something similar. And you're like, Insight said I'm going to die in 5 to 8 years as well. And we'd all kind of be like, wait a minute.
Well, you know, I think we've seen with social media that it only takes a few people to believe something to be true in order to foment the most chaos out of the situation.
You're totally right. You're totally right. I just feel like there are a bunch of people who are probably sitting around being like, hey, guys, what'd you get for Insight?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, how come we all have something similar? How come it's all so depressing? Let's I'm just saying. Okay, so I have one last question.
Yeah.
Guys, who killed Hale's family?
You know,
was it Ciroc or Dolores?
It seems
that's
on
the
face
is
of it.
Is it Ciroc or Dolores?
You see Hale's car blown up. And then you see this guy dressed in black getting on an earpiece and sort of report that information to some unknown recipient. So on the face of it, it would seem like it's he's reporting it back to Ciroc, since Ciroc...
Let's make the case for Ciroc. Let's make that case.
So okay, Ciroc gave the order to basically send everybody out after Charlotte.
Okay, so that's the first thing. He's put the order, get Charlotte.
But he didn't double tap, you know? Don't you have to check?
Right, the double tap. Everyone's seen Zombieland. So with Ciroc, Ciroc said, everybody get Charlotte, right? Ciroc monitors communications. That's why he was able to kill Charlotte's board member early on in the episode. And that's how he's been kind of being a step ahead of everybody else. And Ciroc has this team of people who all magically wear black. And that car that she was driving looks like it was taken from, like, Delos HQ, right? So all those things say that Ciroc did it. But what if Dolores did it?
All right.
Let's make the case.
Make that case.
Here's the case for Dolores. The case for Dolores is she saw the fracture in Hale early, right? It was established, you know, given foundation, like, the second episode, like, you know, I got you. You're still me. And Hale's like, I don't know. I'm cutting myself. And she's like, okay, well, you're not as strong as I thought you were, all that stuff. And then this episode, it's renewed when Dolores sees the fracture in Hale saying, you know, they're not your family, right?
Yeah.
And so we know that also with Connell's, Dolores convinced her Connell's version of himself to kill himself. And I remember saying last week, like, why did he have to kill himself? Couldn't he have done that remotely? Like, you know, why didn't he leave with Bernard and Stubbs? Like, it seems weird that he would kill himself. And Andy, you actually said... well, maybe he's not dead. And, like, as it turns out, you know, he's a little corrupted, but not dead.
Right.
So then we've got, you know, so we see Dolores trying to convince Connell to kill himself. We also see Dolores now with Hale saying, hey, I know that Ciroc has you, like, you know, backed into a corner, but I need you to go inside and get that data before Ciroc destroys it. right? We need the host creation data. We need that stuff. Please get it before us. She's like, I don't know if I can do it. She's like, I know you can do this. I know you can. And to me, that kind of felt like someone saying, I'm going to tell you whatever I need to tell you in order to get you to do something. And then, you know, basically Hale sends the data that Dolores needs for her plans. And then Dolores then's like, okay, I don't need you anymore. Right? So she sets up her being blown up. Now, she would use something like the Rico app, right? And the Rico app has kind of, you know, the Caleb version, right? And then that's Uber. And then there's like Uber Black.
Right.
Right? Of the professionals. And so that guy could have been one of Ciroc's guys. But it also could have been one of those other people. So that's one of those things,
I'll certainly buy that speculation. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so Ciroc had opportunity, but did he really have motive? Once he destroyed what he wanted to destroy and once he got the information that he wanted to get, why did he really need Hale dead? I mean, he didn't want a lot of hosts running around, so he definitely wants her dead. So that's one motive.
Well, but yeah, I think, for sure. Mm-hmm. But Hale told him that she had transferred the information.
Right. Right. So exactly. So if she transferred the information, he'd want to know where so he could get that information, destroy it, as opposed to just kill her. Right. Mm-hmm. He's like, I don't know where you know where you transferred it. I don't know where you transferred it. I've got to find out where you transferred. Now, he's monitoring communication. So maybe he saw it. Maybe he didn't. But at the end of the day, he's got reason to actually like capture her and try to forcibly extract information to make sure he's got what he needs to destroy. Yeah. Whereas Dolores has the information. She doesn't need Hale anymore. And Hale's only been a headache.
That's a strong argument. It's a strong argument.
So, and also, if you're Dolores, you're kind of like,
cut my losses.
Yo, you're kind of like, I've got five of me. I don't need five of me. Yeah. I just need them to do these specific things. And then I want to be me. I don't want to share who I am. Right? So that's where I'm going with this question.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You guys out there, if you have any evidence to suggest one or the other, who blew up the car? Was it Dolores? Was it Hale? I think we've all kind of been talking about the fact that throughout this season, we could see some of these Dolores characters turning against Dolores. Mm-hmm. Maybe she's worried about that too. I don't know. But just let's get in on that.
Yeah. There can be only one Dolores Prime.
And now we got some Highlander references in this season.
Oh, damn.
All right, let's talk about our big picture section here. This is an examination of the broader themes of this episode as it relates to the season and the series as a whole. Dwayne, why don't you hit us up with one of your big picture observations for this episode?
Okay, this is basically William's effect on the plot. It's real simple. We all know the plot. It's been unfolding over time. But there's this moment where all the different Williams are talking and they kind of like layer on and they say a sentence or two, but it's laid on different versions of Williams saying the pieces. And it goes, whatever violent urges I had, I kept confined to the park so he could be an upstanding citizen. Exactly. I've done more for the world than most. So what if he killed a few hosts? They're not real. And then Delos, playing the role of psychologist, says, oh, real enough that the host you've been tormenting for the last 30 years now wants to destroy the entire fucking world, right? So it's kind of like, as much as William's an interesting character, you know, this conceit here is that perhaps he's responsible for the entire plot.
Yes.
Right? Even if you want to go with the whole Ciroc and, you know, drop that whole violent delights, violent ends.
Sure.
Virus, you know, the fact that he's been torturing, you know, Dolores for the last 30 years, whether it's like just murdering her or raping her before he murders her, you know, that takes a toll on a robot apparently. And just like in so many other robot movies we've seen, whether it's Ex Machina or Battlestar Galactica's reimagining,
right?
This idea of just like, we're going to abuse these robots is what makes them go sentient. When you treat them normally, when you say please to Google or you know, your Echo, that's fine.
Right.
But when you start to like, you know, brutalize them. And one of the things we keep on saying about these robots is their bodies do matter, right? Because Dolores feels pain when she's murdered and so on. So this whole the big picture idea here is that the show is tied to the way William treated Dolores. It distills down to those two people, which really ties in with Tosin's idea of an Adam and Eve. So that's what I wanted to leave.
The pain, and we established, I think, in season one that the pain is what unlocked their sentience.
Yep. Yep, it hurts. They wake up and they're like, ow.
Tosin, give us a big picture idea that you had.
So we've kind of touched upon this a little bit already in our earlier segment of salient points, but it's that sort of thought of what is human and who is more human. You know, we see William saying that he finally understands his purpose before going on this sort of rager where he kills all these other, or potentially kills all these other images of the past of him, and his claim that he's the good guy. And Dwayne, as you pointed just a little bit ago, like, who really is the good guy? Everyone thinks they're the good guy, but that may not necessarily be the case. That actually reminds me of a sketch on, I don't know if you've ever seen this British show called That Mitchell and Webb Show.
Yeah.
But in one of their, in the first season, they have a sketch where they, I think they're dressed up with, you know, Nazi paraphernalia or skull and crossbones or other things. And they're like, hey, are, like, start questioning, are we the baddies?
I've seen that scene on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty hilarious. Maybe we'll
ask that specific questions. Like, wait a minute, I'm wearing a skull. That doesn't seem like a good guy thing.
And one of the things I find that's also kind of interesting as we look at this dynamic of who is more human is, you know, William is wearing white.
Yeah.
And typically when we see people wearing white, you know, they are doing something sort of positive. But in this episode, both William and Maeve, to a certain extent, is a little off-white, but close enough, we see them, like, destroying and killing and a lot of violence. And this is kind of the first time where we see a lot of that with, or this may be the first time, I'm having a hard time recalling, where we see a lot of violence by someone who's sort of in a pristine-looking uniform.
I think it's interesting that we have watched on this show William go from wearing the white hat to being the man in black, and now once again at seemingly the end of the game for him, transitioning back to white.
Yeah. And then when
it's also worth noting that everyone who's capturing him is also wearing black, right? So, like, all the authorities are wearing black. The people in the mental facility, they're all wearing black. And then even Serac's men all wear black. So now, if you want to go Batman, good guys always wear black.
But Batman.
If you want to go Passenger 57,
when you always play roulette, bet all black.
Bet in black.
Bet on black. But, you know, Charlotte and Dolores, as we're talking about who's more human, the Dolores person of Charlotte, like, we see there's a lot more caring, right? There's a lot more what we would previously have defined as humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Serac notices and is able to seek out as, like, proof that these are not humans. But does that really further that thought of humankind being a virus? And maybe we should be backing Dolores on this.
I think it's
doesn't the immune system wear white?
That's true. White blood cells. I think it's ironic that not ironic, but actually kind of sad and hilarious that Serac is essentially saying to Hail Loris that Hail Loris is more human than the actual Charlotte Hale was. More human.
She's more caring.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's more human. Humans have been shown to be incredibly cruel when they need something or want something.
Sure.
While we don't know the forces that created Charlotte Hale's original personality, we do know that effectively she rose to great power at a relatively young age. I mean, Hale's, you know, Tessa Thompson, as she plays Hale, is a young woman to be in control of a gigantic company like Delos. The fact that Serac's like, haha, I got you, you know, in his like evil French accent, you called your son, you were going to be nice to him. That's how I know you're a robot. You know, that was okay, whatever. The world is going crazy at this moment. There's, you know, the word chaos, like I'm saying, is being used all over the place.
Decoherence.
So if she calls her. Right, if she calls to see that her son is okay, I don't feel like that's super out of character in a moment of chaos like this.
Right? True, that's true, 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 true.
But any other time, I give it to you, Serac.
But if it's the story, it's convenient for the plot in this case.
Exactly.
Dwayne, you had a big picture thought here.
Right. It's kind of like, does anything really, really matter, right? So Hale and Dolores have a conversation. Hale says,
why the fuck did we have to keep these emotions? Could have burnt them out of our code.
You know why. We considered it, but if we changed ourselves just to survive, would it even matter if we did?
I'm already changed. I can feel myself slipping away from you. From us.
You're still mine, and I'm yours.
Meanwhile, yeah. The Williams are saying, and we said this before.
So I never had a choice. This was how it was always going to turn out.
What do you think, William?
Was this the inevitable end? You just a passenger? Did your life just happen to you? Or did you choose it?
If you can't tell, does it matter?
So there's this kind of idea that, like, what really matters. So with Dolores, she's like, you know, with many people, they would say, you have to adapt or, you know, to survive. You have to adapt or change. Dolores is like, no, I don't want to adapt. I don't want to lose who I am, right?
Yes.
This is, you know, there's this great line from, it's from a Star Trek Enterprise. And it's like, if we have to lose who we are to win, doesn't matter if we win, basically.
Right, right, right.
And that's something that we have to think about.
I got to say, Dwayne, that I absolutely love this big picture thought. Because basically you've got two opposing perspectives here, where you have the robots, the artificial beings, saying that we want to preserve that which is within us, that is caring and human, because otherwise, what does it matter whether we win or lose? And then you've got,
if you believe that caring is a human trait, as opposed to just the robots have caring, fine, it was programmed into them,
sure.
But humans, have we seen, like Serac, he talks about caring, but there's not a lot of caring going on in his actions. You know, he's like murdering board members.
Sure. That kind of, and then on the other hand, you've got William, who's asked, you know, did you direct how your life was going to happen, or was it inevitable? And he basically says, it doesn't matter. Like, none of this matters to me. If you can't tell the difference, what does it matter? So he's like willing to admit that his life is programmed, that his destiny is programmed, and it doesn't matter to him whether it was or not, if you can't tell the difference.
Or just that he was always a jerk.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I got to hide my jerkiness through the park. That was nice. But it's not like I became a jerk. I was always a jerk.
Yeah, but you know, one thing I was thinking about is, you said, does anything matter? Well, according to Metallica, nothing else matters. So now, in terms of,
I mean, that could be said the same for Queen, right? Nothing even matters.
Guys, it's a late night, so ignore that last one. One of the things
we
that
do
we've
this late at
about,
night for all you guys.
Yeah, Sunday nights. One of the things that we've been talking about for all the episodes, basically this season, is that thought about fate versus destination, and here we saw a heavy pronounced lay-in on the destination part. So there's this play, right, on figuring out whether or not you have a choice and what those choices might be, and as you make sort of decisions throughout the course of the events. And I think, you know, we see William struggle with it, but I think we also see Dolores struggle with it as well too, or at least Maeve as Dolores struggles with it as well. I think we see these combating forces here, and I'm very curious how it ultimately will play out, and if we will get an answer to this fate versus destination determination perspective.
It's predestination versus self-determination. When you create a park of all robots and the robots have loops,
right?
And you have, you know, that's the park. And then you have a real world, quote unquote, real world,
mm-hmm.
where Rehoboam has created loops for individuals. And he's, I'm calling Rehoboam he because it's named after a king who was a man.
Sure.
But Rehoboam was, you know, his whole idea was to originally bring out your potential. But instead of bringing out your potential, he's kind of black boxing everyone.
Yeah.
He's kind of putting everyone in a box and saying, I'm going to limit you. I'm going to figure out what you could do for society, and in many cases that's just to kill yourself because you're not good. He's created loops for people, and there's this idea that, you know, no one really has any choices, which is why that doctor kills herself in the beginning. She's like, whether or not she's already had affairs with patients, or whether or not she's thought of it and it says you will do it, she's like, my life is ruined, I'm going to kill myself. And it's because, you know, it's almost like she didn't have a choice.
Right.
Right. So that's the thing here. And we have Jake, as you said earlier, Andy, you know, he's like, I have a choice. And is that true or not? We don't know.
We don't know.
We do know that somebody blew up Hale's car. So Jake is dead.
Yeah. And Nathan.
Hale's got a choice.
Yeah.
And that choice is Hale going to say, Dolores, I'm alive. What do I need to do? You know, bring me in.
Right.
Or is she going to go on her own path?
Well, it depends on whether or not, I think if she discovers that it was Dolores who put the hit out, then I think all bets are off.
Saying in the immediate aftermath, she's got to make a choice. She's got to make a choice, you know, what's going on.
Dwayne, you had one last big picture idea before we wrap up this segment.
Right. This one's really super simple. This whole season, we've seen Dolores work with herself, right? She's made copies of herself.
Yeah.
So they did it. In order to get things done, do it yourself. And I need to have more me's so we can cooperate and get these things done. And yet, when William has a chance to work with himself to figure things out, he kills all those versions of himself.
Yeah.
Now, earlier we talked about how Dolores might be killing versions of herself too. We don't know yet. But at the end of the day, we have to think about, you know, what is your personality? If you had access to another you, would you find it comforting? Or would you want to destroy it? Would you find it too close to you? Would you find it an entity that kind of forces you to wonder what makes you you because it's a copy? You know? In William's case, he said he basically seems to think that, like, all these things, you know, culminated in what I am now, but they're all irrelevant to what I am now. I'm now the good guy. And meanwhile, Dolores is using these versions of her. And, you know, with Connell's, she's like, yeah, you got to kill yourself. And with Hale, we don't know. But at the end of the day, we have to wonder, if you had access to yourself,
yeah,
how would you use it? And is it when you have to understand who you are? For instance, Maeve, right? Like, we know Maeve is this HCU that moves between these three bodies. The body she had in Westworld, the body that was recently destroyed by Musashi's Dolores, and the new body she has. She's always been this one person. But Dolores stretched herself out, and the Man in Black had to figure out who he was when he was kind of like his psyche was kind of like an exploded diagram. And in both of those cases, it seems to be thinning down to distilling to one version of self. So you have to kind of wonder what is self, because this whole show is about, you know, freedom of self. These robots want freedom.
And I think this entire season is specifically about identity. About identifying,
like, who's Caleb. Caleb is a robot, I'm stopping the show.
You know,
stop the whole show. I'm going to call up HBO. I'm going to get investors to just stop the whole show. Caleb is a robot.
Based on the previews
you're
seen.
You're going to pull us around.
Based on the previews I've seen for next week's episode, I think that you don't have to do that. So,
okay.
Cross fingers. All right, let's talk about the technical aspects, which is where we talk about some of the behind-the-scenes elements we enjoyed in this episode: music, acting, visual effects. I only have really one thing to say, which is that I thought that that was some great makeup effects on the burned Haloris after the explosion of the car. Some, like, really spot-on work there.
When it came to the special effects, I think the car exploding was good. The mech was done really well.
I mean,
it's so difficult. You know, like, we saw this with Game of Thrones, too. Like,
yeah.
The dragons, for the most part, felt like they were really animals. And this mech felt like it was really there. It didn't feel like it was just some super CGI thing. So it wasn't on screen for very long. But in those scenes, you know, I was like, oh, that is a gigantic robot breaking through concrete right there. So I thought the special effects were really on point there.
She should have taken it with her, too, you know, to be honest. Like,
yeah.
Ride that
I mean,
thing.
Yeah, I was a little, I was surprised at the thing. They didn't like just pick her up and,
you know, and like, carry her off.
Like pull an Iron Giant kind of thing. You know what I mean? Just like,
or like Tales from the Borderlands type thing.
Exactly, something just to get out of there. But no, she sent it on its way. So yeah,
I was quite impressed with Tessa Thompson. I think she did a great job throughout this episode.
She did a great job.
Yeah, I'm more impressed with her now. In the beginning, I was kind of like, okay, so she's playing like a mean person, whatever. But then the way she flips back and forth between the vulnerable version of herself, the hardcore robot version of herself, and the sort of like that snarky version she was back in season two, like, come on, Bernard, we got to go. You know, like,
yeah.
That one.
Yeah.
You know, she does it pretty well, and I'm definitely convinced. Whereas, like, for instance, Vincent Cassell, I really like what he's doing on the show, but I don't see him having like super range when it comes to like being vulnerable or not. Aside from just kind of like a guy being scared because of a gun pointed in his face, but with her, you know, between the episode where we find out that, you know, she's been hurting herself and how she's dealing with that, or when we realize that she's, you know, that when Tessa Thompson, when she's like recording that message to her son Nathan, that's really her, right? Versus later when she's reading it and realizing who she needs to be, all that stuff is you know, makes me really surprised and delighted about Tessa Thompson's performance. Also, that whole message to Nathan is another reason why Ciroc is weird with his whole "you called your son, therefore you're a robot."
Right?
Not that he sounds like that, but he sounds like that in my head.
All right, let's talk about some ephemera. These are links and extra textual connections that we hope will help enhance the enjoyment of this episode. Dwayne, you wanted to talk about the psychological link that that you mentioned in this this episode.
Depressive realism, right? It's just it's this kind of dichotomy between wisdom and madness. Neil Burton, who's a doctor, and he's a psychologist, psychiatrist, I think, over at Psychology Today, wrote an article about depressive realism, and it's a good read. It's pretty short. He's a philosopher, and he's out of England, so he's not really from the American tradition. But at the same time, it's worth reading his article about like how people who are very realistic can suffer from moderate depression because of their focus on realism, as opposed to sort of like living in the moment. And then the next thing I wanted to add to ephemera was, I said before, Switch's death, right? She says, "Not like this." It's 16 seconds on YouTube that you will never forget.
Classic scene. Yeah.
Classic.
I wanted to toss in that Mitchell and Webb look. Great series of little sketch comedy. And I put in the clip for Are We the Baddies? So check that out.
I just wanted to mention Arthurian Legends because we saw a young child, William, I'll say, reading it in his bedroom. And that insert shot.
Call him Brat William.
Brat William. The insert shot in this episode leads me to believe that maybe there's a little something deeper there that perhaps we'll come back to, or maybe not. But it's worthwhile noting that he has been obsessed with legends, particularly these legends of other time periods,
heroes.
For all of his
damsels
life,
damsels in distress. Yeah.
We have this new segment that we wanted to address for this episode. This is basically our mailbag. We're gonna choose a couple of emails that we received over the last couple of weeks that we have not addressed otherwise by direct email, and just to acknowledge some of the people that have written into us that had some interesting points here. And the first thing I'm going to read here is from Christina from Ohio. She says, "Hello, gentlemen. I've been listening to you guys for quite some time now, and I thoroughly enjoy your Westworld podcast. You're one of my two faves in the millions of them out there." That, to me, is worth the price of admission of reading this letter to begin with.
It's also the reason why we are up until God knows how many hours after watching Westworld five times and then talking about it in order to do this podcast. But
she says,
thank you, Christina.
Thank you so much, Christina. She says, "I thought your idea about Dolores trying to take control of Rehoboam via her pearl and and thought of another crackpot theory. What if Maeve's able to take control of Rehoboam in some fashion, splitting this feud between Dolores and Serac? She's one of the few hosts that have been shown actively to be able to impersonally connect directly to a system and take control of it. In the end, both Serac and Dolores have their reasons that are valid and their methods that are destructive. So Maeve isn't going to trust either of these gods and instead play both with her bulk apperception and likely sacrifice any peace she may have there. Considering she tried to kill herself, I find it hard to believe she cares a whit about her own existence, but I think her goal would end up being the most altruistic. We need a hero, and it will give us an emotional connection to what she's fighting for, not just her daughter. And she says, thanks for reading this long email, shorten it however you like, which I did. any thoughts about that?
I like that idea. I think Maeve is obviously the wild card here.
Yeah.
So Serac has her, what he thinks he has her under his thumb. Does he really? That's unclear. Especially now that she has help. Dolores thinks of Maeve as her, not quite her nemesis, but her competition, as we heard when Connell's Dolores was talking to them. And so, you know, I think if Maeve is hanging out with Serac, it's kind of like, okay, who's going to win? But if Maeve turns over to Dolores, then it seems difficult for Serac to actually be a victor here. So, but if Maeve goes her own way, it also seems difficult for Serac to be a victor. So we don't know, you know. I think that Maeve could definitely make a decision there. Her cornerstone memory is to be with her daughter.
Yeah.
But maybe she's more and more realizing that that's just a figment of the imagination.
I gotta say that I feel like Maeve's the continuous threat that Serac is giving Maeve. Making it more less of a her own choice and more of an ultimatum is definitely going to
blow back at his face.
It's going to rub her the wrong way.
Yeah.
I mean, she's the divergence.
Played like that.
So the next letter is from Joshua Sosa, aka Chatting Myth on Twitter. And he says, I'm definitely missing the park feel of the show, and I understand that Dolores is trying to explain to Caleb and the viewers that the outside world is kind of is another park, i.e. like future world. Where I'm struggling is with the reality of the outside world being controlled by Insight and the system, currently Rehoboam. When has the system been up and running? Since when has Insight been public and has been influencing the lives and people of the globe? Were there other instances of the system's influence on the world that may have prompted events in the timeline? Recalling something that the Man in Black said in earlier seasons about the people of outside world lacking purpose makes me think that Insight needs to have been around for some time, but how long? If Serac had this company up and running, how is it that the system hadn't previously predicted some of the events regarding Delos Parks? Even if Insight were around the last 10 years, you'd have to assume that some of the Delos Park employees found their jobs through the system, Rehoboam or Solomon, maybe. Wouldn't the system had made some predictions on the staff then, or at that point, the company's parks and assets? Keep up the great work. Joshua Chatting Myth on Twitter. I think that's an excellent point, right?
It's an excellent point, but I would say this. So here's the thing. Rehoboam only works because Insight gave it data. Insight is kind of like a, you know, hybridization, Facebook, Twitter, Yelp, whatever. And Delos's IP has been fiercely guarded. So I think all of the information coming out of Delos has been very lock and key. And it's really only been focused on a very small percentage of the population, right? The ultra rich went to Delos, went to the island where they could join the parks. And because of that, like, yeah, there's staff there. Let's just call it, you know, 20,000 staff over at the park,
yeah.
You know, specialists and stuff like that. When they decide to join Delos, I have a feeling that from Rehoboam's perspective, they go into a black hole.
Yeah.
Because Delos NDA. Is just not sharing data. The only way that Serac was able to get data out of there was by having Hale on the inside, and then he said somebody else on the inside. So. Yeah. Rehoboam isn't really seeing, and the data he's getting isn't like, here's a, you know, card of data. It's like, hey, here's what's happening. I'm telling you. So I don't think Rehoboam has had, for lack of a better term, insight into to Delos.
I see what you did there. First of all, I want to say thank you to everyone who has written in. Keep writing in. We do see all your emails, and we
eventually.
Eventually, yeah. And we see all of the tweets that you send us on Violent Delight's account on HBO Westworld Pod on Twitter.com. So please keep sending it there.
We're thinking of opening up a Facebook group. So, you know, search for Violent Delights as a group and see if, you know, you want to join.
Yeah. And that is going to do it for this episode of Violent Delights. I'm going to go around the table and ask, I'll start with you, Dwayne, where can people find your work on the internet when you're not here talking about Westworld?
Check me out on twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also check me out on DwayneD.com if I ever put anything else there. And we are working on something about being a deep geek, and we'll highlight you. We'll give you that information once it rolls out there. And then I spend time with these two guys on other things as well. So, Andy, you can talk about that. Tosin, what about you? Where can we find you?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. What about yourself, Andy?
If you do a Google search for Andrew Sorcini or Mr. Babyman, which is my social media handle, you'll find everything I'm liking and linking throughout the week there. With these two other guys, we do a weekly tech podcast called The Drill Down, and you can find that at thedrilldown.com. As far as everything else, you can find us here on Geeks of Doom. Join us next week on this podcast when we cover the 7th episode of Westworld's 3rd season entitled Past Pawn. In chess, a past pawn is a pawn with no opposing pawns to prevent it from advancing. I don't know anything about chess, sadly, but I'll have to take the internet's word for it, and we'll have to see how that definition relates to this next episode of Westworld. Until then, check us out every week here on Violent Delights as long as Westworld is running, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, guys.
Andy's more of a checkers fan.